This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Opponents of a major gas project off the coast of Western Australia have sought an injunction to stop its development. The Australian Conservation Foundation argues Woodside's Scarborough gas project could accelerate climate change and in turn damage the Great Barrier Reef. So on those grounds, it's pushing for the Federal Environment Minister to conduct a full assessment of the project. For more, here's National Environment reporter Michael Slezak.
Woodside's Scarborough Liquefied Gas Project may sit thousands of kilometres away from the Great Barrier Reef, but the Australian Conservation Foundation says it could doom the World Heritage Site. Kelly O'Shaughnessy is the Foundation's chief executive.
When you burn gas, it creates methane. Methane is one of the most polluting greenhouse gases on the planet.
2 months ago, Woodside was granted major state and federal approvals to kickstart the $16.5 billion project. Because it sits in waters off the coast, its environmental assessment was done by the National Offshore Petroleum Safety and Environmental Management Authority, NOPSEMA, rather than the Federal Environment Minister. However, there's also a clause in the law that offshore projects that are expected to have a significant impact on the Great Barrier Reef should be assessed by the Federal Environment Minister. So the Australian Conservation Foundation, or ACF, has sought a federal court injunction to stall the project while it argues for that to happen.
Well, if successful, the case will set a precedent that all new fossil fuel projects in Australia must be assessed for the climate damage that they could potentially cause if they went ahead.
ACF will argue the project will increase global temperatures by nearly 0.0004 degrees Celsius.
Already at this stage, we are losing vast numbers of corals in bleaching events that are becoming more frequent. So we just haven't got room to increase that temperature anymore.
Dr. Selena Ward is a coral reef scientist at the University of Queensland. She thinks offshore projects should be assessed the same way as onshore ones.
It's absolutely crucial that this case goes ahead and that a precedent is set so that future fossil fuel projects will have to be assessed in the same way. I don't think we can possibly have exemptions. It makes our environmental laws a mockery, really.
The Scarborough project would see gas piped from the gas fields about 375 kilometres off the coast to an expanded processing facility near Karratha. Much of the gas will then be sent overseas. Bill Hare is a scientist with the consultancy firm Climate Analytics.
It's not simply about the emissions, it's also about, are we as a country contributing to the rest of the world meeting the Paris Agreement, which we desperately need the rest of the world to do if we're going to keep our precious assets like the Great Barrier Reef.
A spokeswoman for the Federal Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek says she's unable to comment because the case is before court. In March, Anthony Albanese told ABC Perth he supported the Scarborough project so long as it stacked up environmentally.
That report by Michael Slezak and Penny Timms. And in a statement, Woodside says the Scarborough project's been the subject of rigorous environmental assessments by a range of regulators, and the company will vigorously defend its position. Mental health workers in Queensland have welcomed a new tax on big business to help pay for community and hospital services. It's an idea first adopted in Victoria, and in Queensland's case, the government expects it'll raise more than $400 million a year, as Annie Guest reports.
About 30,000 people with drug and alcohol addictions are helped by the Queensland Injectors Health Network each year. Chief Executive Jeff Davey says 80% of clients also have mental health problems.
Substance dependence are precipitated by complex issues such as trauma. These are people's mothers, their fathers, their brothers. Alcohol and other drug use touches pretty much everybody's lives.
His service is likely to benefit from the Queensland Government's new mental health levy. Big retailers, mining companies and large construction firms will pay a levy of 2.5 cents for every $10 of their wages bill that's above $10 million. The government estimates that'll raise $425 million a year, which is more than a third of the state's current annual mental health budget.
It's amazing news. Demand often outstrips supply in our sector for alcohol and other drug services. There's a big need.
The dedicated funding stream will be set aside for new mental health service beds, including for perinatal and eating disorders, as well as alcohol and drug services. Jeff Davey says people helped by the Injectors Network are supported with counselling and rehabilitation.
So we often deliver programs where people are actively using in the community through things like needle and syringe programs. We work with those people over a period of time, and when they're ready to make changes, positive changes around the alcohol and other drug use, we can very much provide wraparound support and walk them into our therapeutic programs.
Professor Patrick McGorry, the Executive Director of youth mental health organisation Origin, says services desperately need better funding.
Well, this is very welcome news. Mental health has been one of the major casualties of the pandemic, and we were already seeing a global crisis, particularly in youth mental health, over the last decade and more. So starting to see rebuilds in a number of states around Australia is very welcome indeed.
After Victoria, Queensland is the second state to impose a mental health levy, and Professor McGorry wants others to follow.
Mental health's been the poor cousin in terms of funding, and we've been basically cast unprotected into the general health system. And as a result, we've lost funding. Even the meagre funding that we have had over the years has been diverted. So levies and other protective ring fencing devices are very, very important to get a fair deal for people with mental illness.
The government hasn't yet released all the details of where the levy will be spent, but the Queensland Alliance for Mental Health, which represents more than 100 mental health and wellbeing services, wants to ensure that prevention and early intervention services are a priority.
That's Annie Guest reporting there. And if you or anyone you know need help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. As you've probably noticed, the petrol price is surging again. It's above $2.20 a litre in capital cities. Reserve Bank Governor Philip Lowe says petrol prices are up 37% during the past year. And motorists will soon hit another bump with the temporary reduction in the fuel excise due to finish at the end of September, which means prices will probably go up by another 22 cents a litre. David Sparks reports.
With petrol prices spiking again, our cars are burning more money than ever, and for most people it's a big chunk out of their budget.
Well, it's adding an extra $100 a fortnight on my account. They're going to have to do something about it. People won't be able to afford to get to work. Like, I start work at 3 o'clock in the morning. There's no way I can get to work other than by car.
It's also hitting businesses hard. In Hamilton in southwest Victoria, Jan Ubergang runs a taxi service with 9 vehicles.
Well, we've noticed over the last 3 months it's gone up roughly $1,000 a month, which is a huge impact. And we don't feel that we can just put up our fares to cover that. We do move a lot of pensioners and aged care people in the town, so we have to be very considerate before we put our prices up.
Transport expert Marion Terrell from the Grattan Institute says even before the war in Ukraine, prices were rising.
Well, it's really taken off. In the last week or so, the wholesale prices have gone up by about 9 cents a litre for regular unleaded petrol and about 12 cents a litre for diesel. But it's also coming off 3 months of really high prices. We've just seen the increase over that time has been about 46 cents a litre and 51 cents a litre. They've really been rising ever since about the 1st of December. And I think one of the other things that has happened is that OPEC has not been increasing production. So there's a tightening of supply globally, and that is playing out in higher prices.
And she says while it's extremely hard to predict what petrol prices will do next, there's not a lot of cause for optimism.
Just because the pressures that are behind it show no sign of abating at this point.
3 months ago, the Morrison government cut the fuel excise from 44 to 22 cents a litre in a bid to push prices down. That reduction will finish at the end of September, and the new Albanese government has so far resisted extending it.
Well, they're facing quite a difficult dilemma, aren't they? That so this six-month halving of the rate of indexation has cost close to $3 billion. So they've got a terrible budget situation to deal with, and that is a lot of money.
And while it will hurt household budgets, Marion Terrell can see another reason for allowing the fuel excise to return to its previous level.
Because there is both the budgetary problem but also this shortcoming that we don't have a lot of mechanisms for discouraging or dialing down the burning of fossil fuels in vehicles, which are a significant contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. So it is not the worst way for the government to raise revenue, except that, you know, obviously it puts a squeeze on people and nobody likes that.
That's Marion Terrell from the Grattan Institute, ending that report from David Sparks. To the US, and the committee investigating the January the 6th attack on the Capitol building has switched its focus to examine Donald Trump's attempts to pressure state election officials into overturning the 2020 election results. And some of those officials in battleground states have detailed ongoing harassment by the former president's supporters, including threats of violence against them and their families. Here's North America correspondent Jade McMillan.
Protesters gather outside the home of Michigan Secretary of State, Democrat Jocelyn Benson.
My stomach sunk and I thought, it's me. The uncertainty of that was what was the fear. Like, are they coming with guns? Are they going to attack my house? I'm in here with my kid. You know, I'm trying to put him to bed. And so it was... That was the scariest moment, just not knowing what was going to happen.
She's just one of a series of officials involved in the oversight of the 2020 presidential election who say they've faced extraordinary harassment from Donald Trump's supporters. The Republican Speaker of Arizona's House of Representatives, Rusty Bowers, says he's been targeted at both his office and his home.
We have various groups come by. They have had video panel trucks with videos of me proclaiming me to be a pedophile and a pervert and a corrupt and politician and blaring loudspeakers in my neighborhood.
He told the January 6 committee he received repeated phone calls from both the former president and his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who used false allegations of voter fraud to try to convince him to reject the state's election results.
He said that they did have proof, and I asked him, do you have names? For example, we have 200,000 illegal immigrants, some large number, 5,000 or 6,000 dead people, etc. And I said, do you have their names? Yes. Will you give them to me? Yes. The president interrupted and said, give the man what he needs, Rudy. He said, I will.
He was never provided with that evidence and refused to submit to the pressure. Around the same time in Georgia, election worker Shay Moss found herself at the centre of a conspiracy theory when she and her mother were publicly accused by Mr. Giuliani of bringing in a suitcase full of ballots and feeding them through a voting machine, prompting racist and violent threats over social media.
A lot of threats, wishing death upon me, telling me that, you know, I'll be in jail with my mother, and saying things like, be glad it's 2020 and not 1920.
The committee argues Donald Trump's stolen election claims led directly to the violence on January 6, and that 18 months on, the number of people who still believe it means it presents an ongoing threat to America's democracy. This is Jade McMillan in Washington, reporting for AM.
After 7 months of heavy rain that's brought deadly flooding and widespread damage to crops, the La Niña weather event is officially over. Yet there's a but to this story. Forecasters say there's a chance it'll be back by the end of the year. In the regions, though, there's cautious relief, as Gavin Coote reports.
At the weekly farmers' markets in Yamba on the north coast of New South Wales, there's always plenty of talk about the weather. And while it's one of the most flood-prone regions in the country, the market coordinator, Deborah Novak, points out 2022 has been off the charts.
This system that hit us this time, we've experienced some of the worst flooding ever in our area in the Clarence, but also in Richmond Valley and Tweed. So records were completely smashed with the volume of rain here in Yamba. Yamba actually has one of Australia's oldest weather recording stations. So they've been recording rainfall here since 1877, and in this last system they recorded its highest rainfall here in Yamba ever. So it's taken a toll on our fishing industry, of course. So they've had three floods and four freshes since December.
The weather pattern fueling these events, known as La Niña, has finally ended, with the Bureau of Meteorology downgrading its outlook status to La Niña Watch. That means while it's over for now, there's a good chance it'll be back before long, with four of the seven surveyed weather models showing La Niña might reform in spring. Deborah Novak reckons most farmers in her region will be preparing for the next flood.
The Clarence Valley, we're the southern gateway to the northern rivers. So the Clarence Valley itself has the most number of natural disaster declarations in the state. But we still manage to thrive on top of all of that. So we farm flood friendly. Primary producers know not to just, have one iron in the fire. So they, will do other farming practices as well. So you find a lot of our fishermen are also cane farmers, and we find dairy might have processing on their property rather than just, supply. We have plan A and we have plan B and we have plan C and, we actually have plan D now. So it's just about being organised.
This most recent La Nina has been in place since November, and its official end has brought mixed feelings for Graham Forbes, a dairy farmer further south at Gloucester.
Rely on the natural flows in the river, and I suppose that's why the town of Gloucester ran out of water during the drought. Yeah, no sooner went out of a drought condition, and we found ourselves the last 2 years with flood conditions, and this time I suppose it's even worse with total inundation for a long period over the summer and autumn, which makes it very difficult to manage. So we'd like to see just a nice average rainfall with nice distribution throughout the year is the ideal for us.
And is there some sense of relief hearing that La Nina has been downgraded?
I'm not sure. That might mean the start of the next drought, does it? Or that's one of the things with Australia. We're going to stop raining. That's the start of the next drought. So when it starts raining, that might be the start of the next flood. So that's what we've got to manage, and it's not always easy.
If a third La Nina event occurs, it would be the fourth time in recorded history this has happened.
Gavin Coote reporting. Australian researchers are uncovering some secrets about how tiger sharks hunt their prey. Using high-tech cameras, they've tracked the predators on a remote reef off the West Australian coast, and they've spotted some unusual behaviour by turtles in how they avoid attack. Matt Bamford has this report.
Off the coast of Western Australia, some 1,200 kilometres from Perth, lies Ningaloo Reef. The World Heritage Site is renowned for its rich marine life. It's where Dr. Samantha Andreacek has been studying a top predator, the tiger shark.
I originally was just going into it to look at the movement patterns of these animals, how they interact with their prey, how they're moving through the habitats that they're encountering.
Using a high-tech camera attached to the shark's dorsal fin, the Stanford University researcher and her colleagues have been able to track how they hunt. Their awareness appears to be so poor, she says they saw sharks swimming over the top of turtles without noticing them.
They perceive things that are moving more, so we kind of edited the footage and saw what it would see. So from my own personal human eyes, I might see a turtle on the footage, but the tiger shark didn't see that turtle. There was a turtle sitting on the bottom on the seabed and it wasn't moving at all, and it didn't, in terms of the visual system, the tiger shark didn't even register that the turtle was there. But if there were turtles, let's say, up in the water column moving around, we could see that the tiger shark was able to see those turtles.
Tiger sharks are renowned ocean scavengers, known to eat everything from fish to license plates. Dr. Samantha Andreacek says the findings show how the battle between predator and prey plays out.
It's like what we call the evolutionary arms race. So the turtle's adapted to the way that the tiger shark sees, and the tiger shark's always trying to keep up so that it can catch its prey. And turtles may use this as a kind of camouflage. So if a tiger shark's coming along, if it's sitting on the bottom, it can just sit still. And in what all the evidence we saw from the footage we had, the tiger shark didn't detect it at all and it kept swimming.
Tiger sharks have a reputation for attacking people, second only to great whites. Dr. Andreacek says her findings show they favour convenience in their search for food.
One of the biggest conclusions from all my work is that tiger sharks are incredibly lazy. So as soon as something's way too hard for them to eat, they just give up. So in this instance, what I know about tiger sharks is they're continuously moving up and down through the water column, so moving up to the surface, then down to the seabed and back up again. And the easiest way, I guess, for them to catch prey is if a turtle's at the surface. There's nowhere for it to escape. It can see it. It's moving around. So that's where we think they're most often looking for their prey.
Stanford University researcher Dr. Samantha Andreacek, handing that report by Matt Bamford. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. This week, the world governing body for swimming, FINA, controversially banned transgender women from the highest levels of competition. While some of Australia's most successful swimmers welcomed the ruling, it was a devastating blow for the transgender community, with other sports signalling they'll follow FINA's lead. Today, Tracy Holmes from ABC Sport on a divisive debate ahead and what it means for transgender athletes. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.